It's Doug Fabrizio here with just a quick warning before we start the show. The conversations today are about sexual themes that include some candid language, so this might not be for everyone. This week, a sex therapist named Natasha Helfer was expelled from The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Excommunicated is the word they used to use. These days, the official term is withdrawing their membership. Helfer's membership then was withdrawn because of her public criticism of the church's teachings about sex. Now, the letter she received from her leaders said the discipline wasn't for her professional activities as a therapist, just for the criticism part. But it's hard to see how they're not both connected. There were a few things Helfer was saying and writing about that got her into trouble. One of them was her opinion about masturbation. The church sees it as a sin. Helfer says it's not. She says it's a natural part of sexual development. And so right there, you can see the problem. If it's your job to counsel people about sex, to help them find connection and pleasure and intimacy, and then there are these certain, you know, practices and positions that are just off the table, what do you do? It's something the LDS sex therapist Kristen Hodson says she encounters all the time.
There is a young couple that comes into my office and they're looking to spice up their sex life. And as a sex therapist, my assumption is they're wanting some novelty. They're wanting to experiment with new positions. They're trying to figure out how they can enhance what's already going on in their sex life. And being married for 7 years, they're parents of 2 young children, they've been through the birth process. There was an assumption that was made that they already understand the basic functions of arousal and orgasm and pleasure. But doing a deeper dive, I realized, oh, they're not wanting to spice up their sex life. She's not orgasming. Neither of them understood basic anatomy and the clitoris, and that the clitoris is how most female-bodied individuals are going to experience pleasure. So what ended up happening, instead of moving to novelty and positions, turned into an anatomy lesson. This is the vulva. This is the clitoris. This is what this looks like. And they go home and they apply like what we talked about in session. And then they come back and they said, I think we're good to go. This is information and education that they could have had years ago. They didn't know what they didn't know, and they're on their way. This is all too common for young Latter-day Saint couples all the way to experienced couples who have been married for 20 plus years. So it's not uncommon when we're trying to solve a problem, a sexual health problem, particularly orgasm with a female-bodied individual, to suggest that they explore their body, that they get to learn how it functions, how she might feel pleasure, how she might like to be touched. However, that is a very delicate thing to approach within our community, because what can happen is, me being a sex therapist, in my community, people will hear that I'm also LDS or Mormon. And so they'll come wanting to solve this problem of orgasm. But if I'm LDS, there can be an idea of, you wouldn't suggest that because that's not within the moral framework and the values that we both share. And it's this conflict that exists in the room of, well, we're both LDS, so can you help us solve this problem without having to touch my own body? And it can make it difficult. So a couple comes in and they are struggling with being able to orgasm. And I provide the recommendation of a book called Anatomy of Arousal. And in this book, you have hand-drawn illustrations of anatomy, a vulva, a clitoral complex, all of the things that help them understand a female body. And in that book was the suggestion of learning your own body, touching yourself, experiencing pleasure. So I got this email, and the couple had decided to move on after that one session because of what was recommended and the advice that was suggested, because of this recommendation of a book that suggested self-exploration, our therapeutic relationship was over. And that was it. They went to a different therapist that might not make that suggestion, that might help them solve the problem of not orgasming with her never having to touch her own body to figure that out, that he can touch her body, but she cannot. And that is difficult and complex.
If you were naive and you weren't given candid, frank advice because maybe there's some religious taboo associated with it, and you enter into a marriage, you're not having the right pleasure, you don't even maybe know what that means. And there's a boundary. You cannot pleasure yourself to figure it out first, to be able to tell your husband, this is what feels good. That seems impossible. That seems really difficult.
There is such taboo around genitals that that's the unrealistic expectation of, I am not given permission to know my own body, to touch my own body until I'm married, and I still don't have permission to touch my own body, but my partner does. And then I'm expected to tell them how I like to be touched when I do not know. And it's this idea that they're still never entitled, that women are never entitled to touch and know and experience their own body for themselves, that they can know their body for the pleasure of a partner, but not independently. They can explore their body so they can share what they like for a partner instead of, this is my body, this is how I experience pleasure, and if I choose to share that with another individual, I can, but I inherently am entitled to my own pleasure and my own body. That permission is not present. In a lot of ways, that is a cultural nuance of, in my therapeutic space, my office is being limited to talk about pleasure only in the context of a partnership for the experience of them as a couple, with these patriarchal undertones. And it's showing up culturally in a lot of places and having to work with that in this delicate way. Like, there is a cultural competency that therapists have working in Utah or with Mormon population everywhere that have to understand these nuances and subtleties and this dance.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we thought we'd work through some of the questions raised over the last few days by this story of Natasha Helfer. We began the week with some confusion about the case. Helfer's hearing with church leaders didn't go well. There was a confrontation, she was asked to leave, and since she wasn't able to mount a defense, it seemed unclear just what would happen next. And then we learned late this week that her church leaders in Kansas went ahead with the proceeding. They sent her a letter on Wednesday telling her she was out. Helfer herself isn't speaking about this right now, so we'll get some reaction from Kristen Hodson, from her professional perspective as a fellow therapist, but also, we thought we'd start with her personal reaction as a friend of Helfer, but also as a Latter-day Saint.
I was appalled at the process. I was appalled that she had gone to great lengths to gather her defense, to gather information, to answer her questions, to make flight arrangements in a short time frame to get there, to take witnesses that were in good standing. They were temple recommend holding witnesses. And they get there And it all boils down to, because her phone can't be turned off, she's no longer invited to her own counsel. And that process to me was appalling. And that's not okay, just as a human experience, going through something that is so personal, so spiritual, so tied in to your, from an LDS belief, the eternities, the connection to your ancestors and your family. It's not okay.
So I want to ask you, if you're dealing with clients who are LDS, you're a sex therapist, and what are the rules that you're working with? At least your understanding of the rules. And what I mean by that is, when you're going into this relationship with a client or clients, are there sex acts or ideas that are just off limits? Like, what are the rules you're working with when you first start?
Well, it's important that when I'm working as a sex therapist, I'm also a licensed clinical social worker, and I'm bound and guided by an ethical code of conduct. Right. And that is where I'm starting, understanding that I am client-centered, understanding the values of my client, what their goals are, and operating from a professional standpoint, recognizing the culture in which I work. But that is what is guiding me, and to understand where the internal moral conflict lies for them, where the challenges are. But I am not drawing from my LDS framework to counsel LDS clients. I am drawing from my professional ethical code of conduct and having an understanding of the LDS client who's sitting in front of me and wanting to understand what that means for them, and starting to explore the internal conflict that they're sharing.
So Natasha Helfer has made this argument about masturbation, that just in of itself, she says, it's not a sinful behavior. Now, she does say it can become an unhealthy behavior, that it can interfere with daily life and it can be damaging to relationships. But she's also described it as this God-given self-regulatory system where, as she explains it, people can meet their own needs. Now, where does that kind of thinking fit in this therapist community, or the advice that you might offer? Is she an outlier, or is this a kind of consensus way of thinking about it?
There is a consensus among certified sex therapists and professionals outside the Utah community. That yes, that is, even in the American Association of Pediatrics, like, this is deemed in many professions as masturbation is a normal part of sexual and self-development. Yeah. And if left like where it's not complicated through other factors such as shame and moral conflict, they'll move through that just like all these other developmental phases and stages. So there is a general consensus, but it's this idea of who gets to be the authority on this. Hmm. Is it the moral and God authority, and that is law, or the scientific understanding of what is normal development? And I think there's a broad conflict within our culture of who gets to be the authority on that, because you will find other therapists that have spoken out in the wake of Natasha's issue that are saying, regardless if I'm a therapist, I follow God's law first. And God said, no masturbation. Your sexuality is reserved for marriage between husband and wife.
This is a therapist, an LDS therapist speaking, that they can take that prohibition and still, they think, adapt it into the way they treat couples.
Yes. And only drawing on from what they will share publicly, where they're willing to share their opinion. And there is this conflict happening right now of therapists who identify as an LDS therapist or an LDS sex therapist, that it is God's law first. And it's this moral idea on sexuality that's guided by the tenets of a religion or the Bible. And then you have this other group of therapists that is, no, we're bound by the governing bodies of our code of ethics within our profession. You have even therapists that are undermining each other, saying these therapists are harming the faithful because we're not upholding God's law and the religious tenets in which we all belong. Huh.
You know, there's still some question about whether Natasha Helfer was removed from the church because of her positions about certain aspects of sexuality, like masturbation and pornography, for example, or if it was just her approach to speaking out about them. You know, whether she was too confrontational or too provocative or too critical. And I wanted to know what you think about that. You know, as a therapist in a similar situation as Natasha, does this make you think you have to decide what you can and cannot offer in the way of counsel to your LDS clients differently? Or did it just say to you, look, just take a different approach to being public with all of this? Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And, you know, when you go to Natasha's letter of her membership being removed, it states this isn't about your profession. It's not what you do with therapy. It's your public approach and being contrary to policies, the policies and the doctrine and the leaders. And but this isn't about your job, but that is our job. Mm. According to sexual health, that is in conflict. And I think for Natasha, what they're trying to say is do what you want in your therapy office, but don't be public about it. Don't publicly state things that are in opposition to the church. And Natasha's seen as a bold advocate, recognizing that if we are silent, in some sense, there could be this collusion of on the outside and publicly, because we're not saying anything, we're complicit in what how the church is approaching sexuality. We're all in agreement. And then behind closed doors, we'll approach it differently. And Natasha and other therapists who are public are saying our community and communities are desperate for education and knowledge that is medically accurate, age appropriate. And so there can be this conflict of us not only seeing ourselves as therapists, but as sex educators, that this is a much bigger problem, that we don't have enough mental health therapists that can handle all of the sexual issues that are showing up in our community. And what we see as a solution is education. But that is in conflict with policy, doctrine, church leaders. Hmm. Part of my profession is to be an advocate, is to be an advocate for the marginalized, to be an advocate for sexual health principles. I can't just be bound to my individual office. Part of my job is to be public.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things I've heard recently is that a lot of LDS sex therapists felt as though, or some anyway, felt as though that the church was actually headed in a different direction, that there was maybe a greater sense of openness and willingness on the part of the official church to consider suggestions of the therapy community, maybe not give way to, you know, too many permissive ideas, but you know, a kind of an openness. And that now that this happened, that it was confusing, that maybe it's headed the other way. What do you make of that?
You know, I haven't actually seen, while there might be some PR languaging that has shifted, there have been a few things that have occurred. For example, in the youth, like there's a thing called a youth motto that they say that restates their beliefs. And this year, or I guess the year prior, they introduced in the girls' motto that they can now include Heavenly Mother, but it's not in the boys. It's not church-wide that we're going to acknowledge Heavenly Mother. And so what I watch is some possible PR nods to, we're growing, we're changing. However, there are documents in place that still keep in line these very traditional views on sexuality. Mm-hmm. Same-sex marriage can still not happen. This is how we're going to define genders and their roles. The masturbation, still not okay. And so while, again, people could say, I'm seeing change, maybe if you hear it in a conference talk or in a magazine article, but systemic change within the structure, I haven't seen that. I haven't seen that in a meaningful way where the church is then stepping up and saying, hey, we need to go in a different direction, which is going to require trainings and an education and a changing of our materials, and to take these initiatives to move in a different direction. This will take generations, decades to change if it's these little drips, and the church in a very organized systemic way aren't making these changes. So I wished I could be more on board and optimistic of, yeah, these changes are happening. But as long as these documents and doctrines are in place, there's going to be very little change except for at the PR front.
Let me ask you finally, set aside the effect that this this news now may have on LDS sex therapists. What effect do you think this is going to have on couples like the ones we've been talking about earlier, or single people who are wondering about self-care or self-pleasure, or just confused people who don't quite know how it all works? What effect is that going to have on them, do you think?
I've already seen it, unfortunately, a big ripple in a lot of people reaching out saying, does this mean like I was starting to get more comfortable with self-exploration, but now am I in conflict and at risk for my spirituality and my religious involvement? Or people possibly starting to reach out to have conversations with a therapist or start to explore this and saying, no, this, even trying to approach this is going to be in conflict and could cost us our membership or status within the church. I'm already seeing it. I know a lot of my colleagues are already seeing it, of people suddenly doubting and no longer wanting to explore or be curious, or they're afraid and worried that this signaled of, no, those behaviors are not okay. And if you're doing any of these outside of marriage or even within marriage, you could be at risk for spiritual consequence.
Kristen Hodson, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Kristen Hodson. She's a licensed clinical social worker and the founder and executive director of the mental health center, The Healing Group. She's also co-author of the book, Real Intimacy, A Couple's Guide for Genuine, Healthy Sexuality. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
I'm Joel Meyer, station manager here at KUER. Another spring fun drive is in the books, and we want to say thanks to our listeners who sustain and support this radio station. Because of your generosity, we were able to meet our fundraising goals. You and your neighbors will continue to enjoy the interesting conversations and trusted voices you hear on NPR Utah. You can always make a one-time donation or become our newest sustainer at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're responding to the case of Natasha Helfer. She's a sex therapist, a Latter-day Saint up until Wednesday, when she received a letter from her local leader saying she'd been excommunicated or expelled from the church for her public positions criticizing the church's moral code and policies about sex. Now, just another note to make, this is a show about sex and sexual themes, so it might not be right for everyone. And there's a larger history here that we wanted to understand because Mormonism, like other conservative Christian faiths, has changed in its attitudes, if not its doctrines, about sexuality over time. Taylor Petrie is an historian who's written about this history. He's an associate professor of religion at Kalamazoo College, and he told us the relationship between the mental health world and the church itself has shifted over the years, from suspicion on both sides in the mid-20th century to something of a kind of loose affiliation in more recent years.
For many years, church leadership and mental health professionals have kind of had an informal pact. You know, there had been really antagonism in the 1950s and 60s, but by the 1970s, there was a kind of new era, and they literally sort of said, this, a new day has dawned, and we can have a cooperative and compatible relationship with LDS church leaders. And that was really kind of done on sort of two bases. The first one was that mental health professionals said, listen, you've got a marriage problem in the church. Divorce is skyrocketing, and a lot of that has to do with sort of sexual dysfunction in these relationships, and we can fix that. And secondly, we can also solve homosexuality for you too. We'll do conversion therapy. We're going to make all of these gay men and women straight again. And so church leadership finally embraced then the LDS mental health professionals, actually incorporated them in directly into the way that they were doing pastoral counseling by establishing the LDS social services branch of the church, which started to employ professional psychologists for the first time in kind of a cooperative relationship with bishops and stake presidents, where they could refer them out to these kind of safe mental health professionals that would follow the church's guidelines on these things. And, you know, there was always a little bit of tension, a little bit of rough around the edges in this kind of relationship that formed. But here we're seeing, I think, some of the beginnings of the breakdown, or at least the escalation of conflict between these two communities, where one wants to kind of enforce these sort of strict moral codes, and the other is saying, actually, the evidence is leading us in a different direction for what is going to create psychological health and happiness. And so I think we're maybe beginning to see an era of more and more open conflict that's emerging, once again, as there was in an earlier era, too. Huh.
So as far as I can tell, there are three infractions, three areas where Helfer's ideas are in conflict with her church. She supports same-sex marriage. That's one. She has an opinion about pornography that goes against the sort of official idea of the church. She says pornography is not an addiction, shouldn't be treated as such. So she has a view about that. And she also tells her clients that masturbation is not a sin. And I wanted to ask you about this part, because she wrote this blog post in 2012. And she talks about how she could, as she says, no longer stay silent and consider herself to be this ethical mental health practitioner. And so she makes this statement that basically masturbation is not sinful behavior. And in fact, she goes on to say that she makes this argument that not only is it not a moral transgression, but saying it is goes against human nature and this idea, as she describes, as this kind of God-given self-regulatory system. That is, God gave human nature masturbation as a way to sort of regulate stress and pain and hormones. And she even mentions how it can be useful in cancer treatments. Now, what I want to know is, where do these ideas fit in the scheme of things, Helfer's ideas? Is this seen as radical, a little out there? Where is Natasha Helfer and this idea of healthy sexuality as it relates to masturbation? Where does she fit in the scheme of things?
As far as I know, I'm a historian and not in these fields, but as far as I understand them, the history of these ideas as they've developed is that she's right down the center line of where most mental health professionals are today. Yeah. And that really is an interesting sort of history to track, because professional psychologists and mental health practitioners in the late 19th and early 20th century actually took the opposite view on masturbation and really kind of contributed to a broader cultural panic about masturbation as being an unhealthy practice, one which had psychologically deleterious effects and physically deleterious effects, that it could cause disease and all kinds of other problems. So there really was a kind of a full-on kind of social panic about this kind of stuff that was going on. I mean, we go back and to kind of tell the history of the early 20th century, the Boy Scouts were invented as one of their objectives was to, like, get young men to stop masturbating. And mental health professionals were right along with that until around World War II, when the tide really shifts. And there's a lot of new studies that are coming out that are saying, it turns out this isn't actually causing any mental health problems. In fact, quite the opposite. And so the mental health community really flips on these issues after World War II, and that has remained the constant normative view among mental health professionals up until today. So her views are really kind of right in line with that. Now, church leaders have taken an opposite view, and have taken the opposite view. In some respects, they sort of abandoned the earlier physical health problems that early 20th century, late 19th and early 20th century medical professionals were teaching. But LDS leaders held on to the idea that masturbation would cause mental health problems for young men and young women.
What that would be an obsession or an addiction, and it would have
an obsession, an addiction, depression. Yeah. I mean, if you read the anti-masturbation pamphlet from Boyd K. Packer from 1977, he says this is going to cause guilt and depression and you're going to be unhappy. And worse, for both Packer and Kimball and other leaders from this area, they're also saying that masturbation is going to lead to homosexuality and maybe even to bestiality. So they sort of see it as causing these kind of this sort of mental dysfunction that's going to happen to you, and offer an alternative theory of mental health that abstaining from masturbation, self-control, self-mastery, these kinds of buzzwords that they're putting out there, is going to lead to mental happiness and stability. Whereas the professional mental, the secular mental health professionals are saying something quite different. So there really is a kind of conflict that's emerging here on the grounds of mental health between church leaders and professional psychologists.
Dr. Petrie, let's back up just a bit. And I wanted to get your sense of how it is the LDS Church's history with sex has evolved. But I wanted to go further back, like to the early days of the church, because you mention in your writing practices and theology has evolved over time. It's changed over time. But in those early days, what was it like? Was there, and I'm not sure if Mormonism would be different from any other religion, but was there a lot of oversight about sex and sexual behavior, even within relationships? Were there a lot of taboos about sex? Conversations about same-sex relationships or masturbation, or like early on, what did you hear about those kinds of things?
The record is surprisingly silent for most of the 19th century on sexual acts within marriages, what kinds of things were authorized, what kinds of things weren't. Of course, extramarital and premarital sex were strongly forbidden.
Yeah.
And the reason why, one of the reasons why there was a lot of emphasis on that was because it was quite easy to get married for polygamous families in the 19th century. So they presented plural marriage as a kind of solution to the sexual ills of society. They said there's all this premarital sex and there's all of this prostitution and adultery and all these kinds of things. We've got the solution to that. We've got the thing that's that, you know, America.
The solution is polygamy?
Yes.
Wow.
America is sexually broken, and we present to America and to the world a solution to the sexual ailments of the world. And plural marriage was going to be that, right? It would be the outlet for men and for women to be able to kind of, within the bounds of marriage, express themselves sexually.
Was there talk in those days about the purpose of sexual intimacy? In other words, was it considered proper or appropriate to just have sex for pleasure, not to reproduce?
It changes a little bit over time, I think. The reason why is, you know, there are various sexual revolutions that happen in the United States, and one of them happens in the early 1800s. And in fact, plural marriage is in some ways a product of that early American sexual revolution. But as the kind of 19th century progresses, Victorian values, which were much more strict on sexuality, kind of came to dominate respectable public expressions of sexuality, which is why Latter-day Saints found themselves in such massive conflict with the rest of the United States, because they weren't following those Victorian sexual norms. But Latter-day Saints started to express polygamy in the terms of those Victorian sexual norms, especially about reproductive sexuality. So they increasingly come to talk about the purpose of polygamy as having to do with reproduction, a sort of fulfillment of a commandment that they understand is given by God to multiply and replenish the earth. So they're not really talking about spousal bonding. They're not talking about pleasure, because to talk about it in those terms would have been really frowned upon in the broader society and would have confirmed the suspicions that non-Latter-day Saints had about polygamy, that it was really just a kind of justification for self-indulgence and immorality.
Yeah. So what happens after the era of polygamy? Of course, the church, you know, prohibits polygamy in the late 19th century. So what happens after that? Because one of the things you mentioned is we sort of go into this era where Mormons are wanting to assimilate in the larger society. And so what they've done is they start to embrace these ideas of proper sexual morality by what they're seeing in what? Just the other conservative Christian churches in the country, I guess.
You know, yes, and not just conservative Christian churches. These values in the early 20th century were
Everyone's values.
Everyone's
I guess, right?
values, yeah, and yeah. They weren't practiced. In fact, they were, in some ways, there was a kind of class difference between the ways that the upper respectable classes practiced their sexuality and the way that the lower classes did. And Latter-day Saints are trying to kind of glom on to that respectable society because they had been deemed as unrespectable, as having an unrespectable sexuality before. And Latter-day Saints are still more or less isolated. They are branching out, but the bulk of Latter-day Saints are really still kind of isolated to the Mountain West. And they're not really participating in the kind of sexual revolution that's happening in the 1920s.
So when does it take hold? Because they get on board.
Yeah.
It seems. Yeah.
Yeah. So after World War II, there are a lot of social changes that are happening. Of course, the young men have been off. They've lived these independent lives. They've been, you know, fought a war. They come back and go to college and are getting married. And their sexual values in the 1950s and 1960s are quite different from those of their parents' generation, who were, you know, lived in a different era, lived in different lives. And urbanization is happening. People are moving around. Kind of the old institutions are crumbling as new, kind of a new age that's dawning in America. And the sexual revolution is a big part of that. And Latter-day Saints are kind of looking at that pretty warily. But they belong to a broader cultural resistance to the sexual revolution that is emerging here as fundamentalist Christians and evangelical Christians and conservative Catholics are sort of finding themselves on the outs of that broader cultural change, and they kind of band together to fight back, and they eventually kind of form an alliance around these sort of resistance to the sexual revolution that comes to the form as the religious right, which has a political dimension to it, but is really kind of trying to affect a society overall by kind of holding on to a nostalgic view of an earlier era of sexuality that is quite different from the direction that things were going.
Talk a little bit about where a Mormon leader by the name of Spencer Kimball fits in all of this. You say that he makes sexual morality kind of the central message of his ministry. He writes this book called Miracle of Forgiveness. Say a little bit about that, because I want you to talk about how Kimball's ideas were pretty rigid in terms of sex, and you write about how he has one of his innovations basically is to establish this greater oversight about sexuality within the church.
Elder Spencer W. Kimball in the 1940s is given the unfortunate task of kind of counseling with members of the church who are involved in what were then called serious sexual sins. And this is kind of scandalizing for him and ends up having a profound effect on the next 40 years of his career, where he makes sexual morality kind of one of the defining features of what he's all about. So he's involved in kind of counseling about this, and he sees it as having these hugely destructive impacts on the lives of the people who are caught up in sexual sin, and ultimately corrosively on the society itself, that he sees as kind of being weakened by the sexual immorality of the individuals within that society. And so among the various innovations that he's involved in are developing the idea of youth interviews, where bishops will sort of intervene in the lives of young people from the ages of 12 on up, especially young men, screening for masturbation, screening for homosexuality, in order to kind of catch it early. And then, you know, correct the young person on their way so that they can kind of reform themselves, as opposed to, you know, having it go on for 10, 20, 30 years. And then it's more difficult. So he said, we got to start early with these young people and have these new techniques for kind of discovering sexual immorality among the youth and then correcting it as well. So in addition to that kind of strict oversight that he establishes, they also, as we mentioned, have LDS social services stepping in, a professional psychologist who are going to work with these people, and really kind of builds an entire infrastructure around monitoring and correcting young people's sexuality specifically.
I'm not sure if it's around this time, but one of the things that you write about is this BYU professor named Kenneth Cannon. In 1976, he calls for what he says he wants to see a Mormon philosophy of sex. So explain what he means. What is he seeing, and what is he not seeing? What does he want? What does he mean by a Mormon philosophy of sex?
The title of his essay is In Search of a Mormon Philosophy of Sex, and it would seem surprising for someone in the 1970s to say that there was no Mormon philosophy of sex at that time, because that was all that LDS leaders were talking about. They seemed to be obsessed with it. You know, Kimball was talking about it all the time.
Yeah.
But what he means by that is this kind of subtle insider critique, insider to the Latter-day Saint tradition, critique of the LDS tradition as being too focused on prohibition and repression rather than having anything kind of positive to say about the goods of sexuality, about what are the things that are good about it, and why is it something that we actually value and care about. And he says there's a real problem that he had observed as a mental health professional himself. He taught marriage and family relationships, and he did private counseling as well. And he was really kind of seeing a real dissatisfaction among Latter-day Saints and their sexual lives in the 1960s and 70s. And he says, you know, what we need is to kind of take an offensive position here where we actually come out in favor of sexuality rather than just always saying no, 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 no. And develops, and where you say, and I think I'm right about this, to say that there is a kind of quiet Mormon sexual revolution that is taking place behind the scenes where Latter-day Saints are adopting the values of the broader sexual revolution, that sex is something which does bring personal fulfillment, which does bring happiness, which is more than just reproductive alone, and trying to kind of write that into a Mormon theology. And so Latter-day Saint leaders are finding themselves having to kind of back away a little bit from the reproduction-only theory of sexuality, which they had very strongly taught, most vocally in their opposition to birth control for so much of the 20th century. And Latter-day Saint psychologists are really on the forefront in the 1970s of telling Latter-day Saint leaders, you've got to stop this anti-birth control crusade. It's causing so much unhappiness among the membership. They're not really listening to you anyway, because Latter-day Saints were using it anyway, and it was just making them feel terrible that they were in conflict with the church. And they more or less convinced the church to kind of back away and say, birth control is a private decision. It's not something that the church is going to take an active position on anymore. And that's part of where I think that when I say that this is a sexual revolution, it's an expansion of the domain of what sexuality was considered among LDS leadership, where it had once been restricted to be reproductive alone. It now expands into the realm of personal pleasure, into spousal bonding, into kind of taking on a little bit a broader sphere of meaning in the LDS community.
So if you were among the rank and file of the church in that era, and you start to see maybe an opening, and you have all of these questions about, like, you know, what is approved, what is not approved, how much experimentation can we engage in as a couple? So I guess this is when emerges this period where people are looking for these, I think you describe them as intimacy guides. People are looking for kind of a manual for some guidance, I guess.
Yeah. So one of the things that the broader sexual revolution brought to American culture was the kind of sex manual. So, you know, The Joy of Sex and all of these other kind of best-selling books that were designed to kind of walk people through the physiology. It was this was an era where there was no sex education in schools. Parents didn't necessarily know this stuff. You know, it's like, where do you turn for this sort of information, even just some of the basic facts about things? So there was this whole genre of books that's being written, and Latter-day Saints start writing these intimacy guides or sex manuals as early as the 1960s. They're almost always written by mental health professionals during this time period. And they're hugely popular, especially among newly married people. And they're often targeted towards newleweds. But yeah,
Hold on. So if you're a newlywed and you're Mormon and you go find one of these manuals, what are you looking to find out? Like, and what I mean by that is, for example, what will one of these intimacy guides that's approved and sold at Deseret Book, for example, what will that tell you if you're young and really want to know how far you can go? What does that tell you about oral sex? What does that tell you about masturbation? What does that tell you about orgasms? Is that what they're looking for in these guides?
That's absolutely what they're looking for in these guides. Yeah. And they change over time, and they become more and more explicit and more liberal, I guess, progressive, you could say.
Sure.
Even the quote-unquote the conservative ones today say that masturbation in the context of marriage is just fine. You know, that those ones are sold at Deseret Book. You know, they try to be very careful around the kinds of things. And they often will say many of these things are left to individual decision rather than saying, you know, these are the rules that you can and can't do anymore.
Maybe, Dr. Petrie, you could mention the kind of dust up over oral sex, because it seems like that was a good example of this, that Spencer Kimball got word of the idea of oral sex happening among couples, and he said absolutely not, and then he had to change. So this seems like a good example of that.
Yeah. So in 1981, he sends out this this letter. Spencer W. Kimball sends out a letter to all of the church leaders to be read in sacrament meetings and priesthood and relief society meetings.
Wow.
That says that unholy and impure practices, which was one of the wordings of the temple interview, include oral sex. And if you're participating in this, then you're not worthy to enter the temple. And bishops should be asking couples about this.
Wow. This is 1981.
This is 1981. And it causes a huge uproar. Bishops don't want to be involved in these conversations. Married couples say it's none of your business, you know. And so, you know, there's a really kind of a backlash against this. And just several months later, I think it's like eight to 10 months later, they send out another follow-up letter that says, okay, don't ask about it anymore. It's kind of becomes a don't ask, don't tell situation. It still is considered an unholy and impure practice, but don't ask about it. If somebody asks you, you can talk about it, but bishops and stake presidents are not supposed to ask about it anymore. And because it's married members who are kind of pushing back against this, they actually have a lot of leverage here. Where, again, the young people, the 12 to 18 year olds who are saying, I don't want to do these interviews, they don't have any real leverage there. But the church listened to the married people and said, well, okay, we're not going to follow this. We're not going to do that anymore.
So let's come back to Natasha Helfer and where her predicament fits in the scheme of this. What does this tell you about where now the church seems to have landed in terms of the way it thinks about sexuality, if anything? You've got Helfer, who's pushing some boundaries, who's raising questions about the role of masturbation in you know, healthy sexuality, the question even of pornography, same-sex relationships, which is maybe even another thing. But what does her predicament tell you about where we are now in Mormonism?
I think there are a couple of interesting stories that this episode illustrates for us. The first is the way that members, many members of the church, and mental health professionals of the church are often at odds with LDS leaders on some of these hot button issues. And we've seen these kinds of tensions arise over and over again in LDS history, and oftentimes they lead to positive change, as in the case of oral sex, as we mentioned, as in the case of birth control that happens not long after the change in oral sex rule happens in 1983. So we see the ways in which the members themselves kind of push back against the sexual norms that an older generation of church leaders are attempting to kind of maintain and enforce. And that kind of conflict is, again, it's one that happens over and over again in church history. And it's one that often does lead to some kinds of progressive relaxation of these kinds of changes. Now, a lot of members actually do hold to the more strict views of those things, but a lot don't. And so I think that we're seeing a kind of a division, a sort of civil war within the church on some of these issues around sexual morality. The second thing that I think that is really interesting to pay attention to is the way that we're looking at competing ideas of mental health that are at stake here. And I think that it's important to understand that Natasha Helfer is representing a professional view here, and one that is shared by almost all of her professional colleagues on these kinds of things. But Latter-day Saints, and to go back to this, Latter-day Saints have offered an alternative theory of human happiness based on sexual restraint, and an alternative theory of social well-being based on sexual restraint. The Proclamation on the Family is a classic example of this, of trying to kind of have a sort of public interest in what many people understand to be private sexual choices. And so this kind of these kind of competing theories here of mental health that are operating between the religious and the professional authorities here is, I think, something that's worth talking a little bit more about and kind of understanding the different perspectives that those two sides are coming from.
Taylor Petrie, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Taylor Petrie, he's the author of the book Tabernacles of Clay, Sexuality and Gender in Modern Mormonism. He's an associate professor of religion at Kalamazoo College in Michigan. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.